Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Gilcrease Museum will open a new exhibition this weekend devoted to arguably the finest artist to ever work and live in Tulsa. Alexander Hogue today is viewed as one of the top American regionalist painters of the 1930s and 40s. As a member of the Dallas Nine, Hogue depicted the mountains of New Mexico, the effects of the Dust Bowl through his Erosion series, a combined celebration and condemnation of the effects of energy exploration on the landscape, depictions of ranch life, and later, an exploration of the rugged Big Bend country of West Texas. But his reputation was not always so. Throughout his life, Hogue experimented with a number of different forms, abstraction, geometric forms, before returning to a hyperrealism later in life, all while being mostly dismissed by the New York art establishment critics. Well, that assessment is being changed in no small part by the efforts of my guest today, independent curator Susie Khalil. Khalil put together a massive 200-piece retrospective of the artist's work in 2011, and her book, Alexander Hogue, an American Visionary, argues that we should include Hogue among the greatest American artists of the 20th century. A smaller version of the retrospective opens this Sunday at Gilcrease. I spoke with Susie Khalil back in 2011 when the exhibition was first touring, and I began by asking Khalil about Hogue's reputation as an American artist, both in his time and today.
Well, actually, he was considered a major artist in his time during the 1930s. In fact, he was, I'd say, in the trifecta of the art world. His works were included in the Whitney Biennial, the Carnegie International, the National Academy, the Venice Biennale, collected by major institutions throughout the world. But Alexander Hogue constantly pushed himself, taking risks. He never repeated anything in his work. He was always experiencing nature, observed an experience of it in his time. So when the Dust Bowl was finished, he didn't want to keep cranking those paintings out. The Dust Bowl was over with. So his work became increasingly abstract. He went into new directions. And at the time, I think curators and critics and collectors didn't know what to do with it. They weren't ready for it. He was ahead of his time at every turn he went against the grain. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think in the past, American art had the tendency to categorize. And you had this canon, kind of like beads on a string. And Alexander never fit that kind of profile. Right now, we have a paradigm shift going on in American art about what American art was, is, or could be. And there's an entire reevaluation. So I think actually his time is ripe at this point to establish him as a major 20th century American painter.
You know, it's interesting. The difference between European art and American art is pretty striking. When you look at Picasso or, you know, some of the 20th century masters, you see that sort of, I'm going to do this for a little while. Okay, I'm going to move into this. I'm going to move into this. I'm going to move into this. And that's accepted. And that's accepted as really sort of the artistic ideal. Mm-hmm. What you're saying in American art is we want something, okay, you can make an innovation, but then we want it to be the same. We want to see more of it, like the Dust Bowl paintings. And in cases of Hogue, you know, he starts out influenced by the Taos school. He's doing Taos sort of school images. He does moves into the Dust Bowl. He embraces some aspects of precisionism, and he embraces industry with his oil series. Then he goes into this sort of calligraphic sort of series where it's, you know, he's putting big, huge numbers on canvases, doing abstract work, and then he's coming back to sort of his roots with the Big Bend series. Mm-hmm. So he is constantly moving, and the art world rejected that sort of idea?
Well, it's always about nature experienced or observed. And I've always considered Alexander a true visionary. What was right in front of him? What was in his mind's eye? What did he see? What did he know? And how is it manifested in the work? And for him, the abstract part of his work is also an intrinsic part of nature. Those calligraphic one-liners, for example, I mean, if you look at them in one respect, they're like double helixes or DNA. Or, you know, when you think about the forms of nature being ellipses, spirals, or out in a landscape looking through, across, underneath. I mean, it all, when you see his work through the century, together, as we look at it in this book and in the retrospective, you see it actually as one piece. And that's how he considered it. He didn't see it as just portioned segments in little compartments like that.
What was interesting to me is, I don't know if this is coincidence or not, but you know, at the time he starts teaching here at the University of Tulsa, all of a sudden he starts experimenting with new forms. I'm wondering, do you think teaching informed that sort of exploration? Because he's making some attempt to, through his own artistic prism, to deal with abstract expressionism. I don't think he ever did anything really in the abstract expressionism field. But
well, the abstract part of his work has always been there. I mean, since the early 1920s. And I definitely think that was part of his training as a hand letterer in New York. That
you
kind
mean
of
abstract in the way he would create figurative pieces?
His forms and cells, his brushstrokes. Mm-hmm. If you get close to any of his paintings, any one little segment is a gorgeous abstract painting in and of itself. And his vocabulary forms, his language, you'll see serpentines and arabesques and diamond shapes, chevrons, flecks, daubs, so jabbing strokes. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of, and it becomes, like I said, it's part of his training as a hand letterer, that kind of precision. He really knew how to cut an edge. And so any of his paintings, and I have looked, I mean, I have been with Alexander Hoag studying this for over 28 years, and he can hold it edge to edge mm-hmm. of the canvas. He never drops out. You know, a less experienced artist or one that doesn't have the passion, and the desire and the will to examine the basic truths of a landscape or nature or a portrait or whatever, or just the lack of inner drive, will allow the paint to just kind of muddle and fizzle out and drop out of the corner.
There'll be weak spots. Maybe.
Weak spots, mm-hmm. exactly. You won't find that in any of Alexander Hoag's paintings.
And yet, the way he composes the scene, the eye is drawn exactly where you want it to. You
know, exactly.
Fence posts are one of his great devices, a barbed wire fence. He loved to paint that to show us where to really as a big arrow to direct our eye.
Absolutely. In any of those erosion paintings, either by water or wind, that he uses the barbed wire, actually, it's a very delicate, almost serpentine and arabesque, and you can follow your eye to get your eye back into the depths of the painting or across the fence post just to traverse from one side to the other.
That's the other thing that's interesting about his landscapes. They have a tremendous amount of depth to them. You know, you go from the extreme foreground to the extreme background, and some of the most interesting parts of the painting are in the extreme background.
Absolutely. And one aspect of his life that I explore in the book is his participation in theater. When he was in New York in the early 1920s, we don't have that very many examples of painting done at that time. He was studying at the New York Public Library, looking at Persian calligraphy. He was visiting museums and galleries, but he also was a frequent visitor to the theater. He would sit up in the peanut gallery. So when he got back to Dallas, he was also an integral part to the Dallas Little Theater and building sets. I think a lot of that is evident in his works, that kind of view from above and directing the viewer's eye to the depths, how you get the viewer to move your eye back layer after layer after layer into the distance.
Well, as I was mentioning, you know, he starts out going out to Taos. You know, lots of painters are discovering New Mexico at the same time. But pretty quickly, he focuses on his native Texas. And he was sort of moving back and forth between the Dallas area, Palo Duro Canyon, which, that is another great subject to paint, and New Mexico. What made him focus on Texas, which he does really with the erosion series?
Well, Alexander, you have to remember, he was born in 1898 in Memphis, Missouri. His father was a Presbyterian minister. So at 6 weeks of age, Alexander and his five sisters, mother and father, moved to Denton, Texas. So that's where he was based as a young boy. When his father died, when Alexander was not even 10 years old, they moved to Dallas, and Alexander at that time started gravitating towards commercial design and hand lettering to support his family. So he was already based in the Dallas area. the Glen Rose area, the Paluxy River. It was a good base for which he could explore the various areas. At the same time, his sister and brother-in-law had a ranch in the Texas Panhandle. So when he was a young boy, he would spend summers with them, tending sheep, breaking horses, and would also camp out for weeks at a time by himself at the bottom of the Palo Duro Canyon. Yeah. There are several pastels of that time. And it's interesting, because Alexander was so precise in terms of the geology, in terms of what he was seeing and experiencing, they are actual records of areas of Texas, especially Texas, that no longer exist. The cedars at the bottom of Palo Duro, they're gone.
Interesting. Well, how did he come upon the erosion series? Obviously, it's the news in the 1930s, major dust storms blowing up through Texas, inundating towns in dust and sand. Was it just, it was over an overwhelming environmental event that he felt like he had
to
pay?
Well, absolutely. Alexander told me years and years ago, he said, mark my words, the key issue for the next century is going to be water, our lack of water, drought, too much water, the superstorms, spontaneous fires erupting. And unfortunately, he was more correct than he even knew at the time. I think the work even has more relevance now because I think of his paintings every day in the news. Again, he wanted to produce work that directly communicated his experience of nature observed. It was right there in front of him. He experienced the Dust Bowl firsthand. I mentioned as a young boy that he would stay with his sister and brother-in-law, Wiley Bishop, up in their ranch in the Texas Panhandle. So at that time, the Panhandle was this vast area of lush grasses and antelope. It was beautiful. When the suitcase farmers moved in and leached water off the land, soil overplowed the land to our worst ecological disaster, he was there. It was so horrible, he told me, but he had to paint it. There was a kind of terrible beauty in it. He didn't want to do social commentary, but he wanted to raise an alarm. It was there. He had to paint it.
It was social commentary, but it was very subdued social commentary because figures didn't enter into they were pure landscapes. But what you had oftentimes were houses, you know, abandoned farms.
And dead cows spilling into the viewer's space.
Right.
No, there were no figures, although Alexander also told me, he said, you know, people tell me that there are figures in my paintings, pieces, but I never put one in. I said, you know, I didn't mean to do any kind of scathing social commentary, but, you know, this is what I was seeing.
But, you know, some of the best images of that series, which being an Oklahoman, I would say is Mother Earth Laid Bare and The Crucified Land. This is different than the earlier erosion series, which are really just sort of almost journalistic looks. You know, whether it's the, you know, the dust that's covering the railroad or, mm-hmm. you know, the home that's, you know, and the dead cows.
Right.
You know, and some of the, they're journalistic. Mother Earth Laid Bare and Crucified Land, you're getting in all sorts of symbolism and things that are, I don't necessarily associate with some of those other
Absolutely. And I say that Alexander didn't intend any kind of social commentary, but that doesn't mean there were scathing reactions because of this. In 1937, Life magazine published an article about the Dust Bowl and reproduced several of Alexander Hoag's paintings in black and white. And we have to remember at that time, Life magazine was a very important vehicle out there for the news. And it so enraged a West Texas Chamber of Commerce when they saw some of Alexander Hoag's erosion paintings, for example, drought survivors, they threatened to buy that painting and burn it publicly in the town square. Well, that's exactly the painting that the Jeu de Paume, the Louvre Museum in Paris, chose to purchase out of the 1938 Paris Exposition at the New York World's Fair, the director of the Louvre at that time considered it the most important American painting that he had ever seen.
Mm. And of course, that unfortunately, the original painting is lost to us.
Yes, that's a story in itself. After the Louvre purchased that painting, we flash forward to Hitler's march on Paris, and the Louvre asked the Museum of Modern Art at that time in New York to shelter that painting and several other works from the collection. After World War II, it was returned to Paris, to the Jeu de Paume at that time, and friends of Alexander's actually saw it hanging in the museum. After that, however, it went to a huge exhibition at the Tate Museum in London, 300 Years of American Art. When it returned to Paris, it was stored in a warehouse in Pantin. Unfortunately, there was a huge fire. Alexander's painting was destroyed, along with a Botticelli, a Winslow Homer, many irreplaceable works. Well, Alexander never got over the fact that what he considered his best painting, collected by the most renowned museum in the world, was no longer. I mean, it was destroyed. So it bothered him for nearly a half a century. So almost 50 years later, he decides to repaint it using only the black and white photo from the Life magazine issue of 1937 and what was in his memory. And it's almost an exact duplicate. I consider it almost a better painting because at the same time, he was at work on his Big Bend landscapes. So when you stand in front of the 1984 version of Drought Survivors, the air is just, you can almost feel the dust choking in your throat. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. And the cows literally spill into the viewer space down those sand dunes.
I want to talk about the next, after he gave up the erosion series, he went through this period where it was kind of, in a way, celebrating the oil industry. And I don't know if those were commissioned works, but it kind of reminds me of sort of like some of the artists of the 1930s that were celebrating, you know, American industry. You had Sheeler working in Detroit area and celebrating American power and ingenuity and industry. He seemed to have his own sort of take on that, but it was out in the natural landscape where you see, you know, oil pipelines going through this rugged badlands, if you will.
Absolutely, and there is that kind of relaxed precisionism to those works. Alexander, in all of his paintings, there is that balance between the abstract, the real, the organic, and the mechanical or geometric. In Oil in the Sand Hills, which later was donated to the Pompidou in 1944 as a replacement for the burned painting by actually a University of Tulsa student, a former student of Alexander Hoag's, William A. King, who worked for the government services at that time. But there is something of Sheeler and also Ralston Crawford, who corresponded with Alexander. But again, Alexander, he knew the landscape. He was not a casual tourist. He walked it. He felt it in his bones. So he went out to West Texas, Crane County, in the Iran area with Gulf Oil and spent a lot of time out there studying the pipelines, the valves, you know, every nut and bolt that went into the oil fields. I've had a number of readers of the book actually come up to me and ask, well, if he was such a critic about the Dust Bowl and man's misuse of the environment, you know, how could he
celebrate the
oil fields? Uh-huh. And what would he have to say today about that? And I say, well, Alexander was really a man of his time. And at that particular time, he felt that the oil industry actually performed clean extractions and were very environmentally conscious about how they dealt with the oil fields there and that specific environment in West Texas.
I think one of the things this retrospective does, it puts into balance this era of painting during the 50s and 60s. You know, he's teaching at the University of Tulsa. There's all sorts of new currents. It's, you know, figurative painting is out the window, and that's what he did. and he's, okay, well, how can I, within my craft and art, express myself. And he does these series of number paintings, you know, the 23 Skidoo. It's got a 2 and a 3. It's a very, very modern serif, if you will, and a little Skidoo written in. And there's these puns, if you will, on this number series and these calligraphic sort of series. And I didn't know what to make with them when you see them singly. But when you see them together, you go, oh, wow, this exhibit really puts those paintings in a new light. And you really see he's doing in the 50s what all sorts of artists were doing in the late 60s and early 70s.
He was always ahead of his time. And part of that, he was always true to himself. And that's a very important point. He didn't follow any trends or styles. One significant point, I think, when Alexander came to establish the art department here at the university in 1945, it was right after World War II. There was an influx of GIs. The oil industry was just on the go here. So there was an influx also of Middle Eastern students. He didn't have time to get in the studio and produce those painstaking landscapes. So the modernist works were actually...
as much time-driven as anything else?
They took less time, and yeah. So he was able to produce those more quickly. He was just so busy putting this art department together. And remember, after World War II, there was a shortage of materials, canvases as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. But again, the alphabeticals, the calligraphic one-liners, there is always this aspect of language in Alexander's works. And a lot of people don't realize he wrote poetry. Mm. And he was also very involved in music, you know, and the theater. So when you stand in front of these works taken together, they produce almost this kind of musical composition. And the titles themselves have this kind of three-syllable, onomatopoeia, kind of jazzy tune to it. Like a university painting here in the collection is Zinigo ZZ, or Zim Zimmery Zim, mm-hmm. Kiss Cousin Zin. So you have that kind of snap to it. A lot of people don't realize that there is no taping to those hard edge works. It's all freehand, which is incredible because you get these astounding tension points and just pats and scraping of the palette knife. So literally when the light hits these, I mean, they take on this resonance that just the entire wall just is activated into this dazzling array.
Let's talk about his last series in our last few minutes, and that's the Big Ben series. In many ways, he's kind of moving back to some of these landscapes that we came to know in the 30s, but they're totally natural landscapes. They're not showing man's impact. It's the natural beauty of this particular place. He had visited Big Bend in what, the 20s and 30s?
In the early 1920s, he made three mm-hmm. trips out there with Frank Ray, a Dallas artist, just into the wilderness. And again, when you think about it, they were going out there.
Oh, the Big Bend was in the middle of nowhere.
Nowhere. Yeah. And they would no go roads. Out in the Model T and leave it. And then they were out there camping for weeks yeah. on end.
So what got him back into doing that particular part of the world?
Alexander told me that Big Bend was always his favorite spot on Earth. There is a clarity there in the sky, and also this illusory aspect where you're out there and clouds meld with the mountains and your sense of distance changes. And he felt, as a matter of fact, I used the word desolate to describe that area once, and he said, strike desolate from your vocabulary. That's the most, you know, the richest area on this planet. And he proceeded to just list dozens and dozens of flora and fauna. And like I said, he knew that area in his bones, mm-hmm. Just felt, walked it, experienced it. I think he always carried that with him. Significantly, he didn't return to the area until the early 1960s, mm-hmm. 1965. And he had a summer teaching position at Sol Ross University in Alpine. So it was his opportunity. He would get up before dawn, get out into the Big Bend landscape by himself. He produced, for every painting, he produced a pastel first. He would call his kind of like shorthand notations that he would finish up. And he said they're almost like stenographer's notes. But he had such an incredible memory that he would know exactly geologically where the place was, you know, that particular point of, you know, perspective, everything that came into it. And he would produce the paintings back in his Tulsa studio.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting. You know, you could look at a Big Bend landscape. You could see a Hoag painting of that same landscape. You would go back and look in real life. All of a sudden, you see that landscape very differently. And when we were chatting beforehand, I said, the colors are in the landscape. He takes them and sort of magnifies them 500 times, the colors that are in the landscape. And then when you go back and look at that landscape again, the actual landscape, all of a sudden those colors are speaking to you. Because they were always there, you just didn't see them.
Absolutely. And there's always that observing eye. Again, what did he want us to see? There's always a distinct perspective. Every single view of those Big Bend landscapes, there's truly something mystical about them. They're all of the works, but especially the Big Bends, these final paintings. And you have to remember, many of those, he was in his late 80s, early 90s, when he produced these almost precisionist works. The control, the mental faculties, the clarity of vision, the colors, all of that are incredible when you consider, I mean, he was doing great art at an old age, which is a rarity.
Rare.
Very rare. Yeah. Very rare. But again, there's something extremely mystical about it. There's a translucency, an inner glow that comes from them. And I tell you, when I stand in front of them, they change with the light of day. Wherever you see them, whatever environment, there's something living, breathing inside of them. And I think there is, he wanted to point out again that we are integral to all of this, all of the landscapes. We are a part of it, but we are also just tiny specks in the whole scope of the universe. And we have to pay attention to the fragility of this wilderness. He knew this. He was painting these when he was in his early 90s. He knew he would never get back to see this landscape again. So there's something about his mortality, our mortality. When you stand in front of those works, it's almost as if you're looking through the eyes of the last human being on Earth.
Well, Susie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich, for having me.
Art curator and scholar Susie Khalil speaking about Alexander Hoag back in 2011. She's the curator and lead author for the exhibition and monograph Alexander Hoag, an American Visionary. An exhibition opens this Sunday at Gilcrease Museum and runs through November 30th. As an extra treat today, we have a snippet of Alexander Hoag from 1993 when the artist was 95 years old, speaking with my late colleague Edward Dumit, and he was talking about his relationship with the New York art establishment and how he felt appreciated by the public, but not by the critics in New York.
Yes, but not by the particular people that think they had the dominance of things in New York, for instance. I was not supposed to be a part of that. I didn't care to be anyway, because it wasn't the kind of things that of abstractions that I want to do. And so I concentrated on this country out here and was satisfied to stay right here, right along, but to show everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. I've so practiced everything I've done.
That was Alexander Hoag speaking just around his 95th birthday with my late colleague Edward Dumit back in 1993. Alexander Hoag, an American Visionary, opens Sunday at Gilcrease Museum. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.